This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'm reading Jeff Wilson's book, Wrong Tree, published in 2022 by Cornerstone Press in Stevens Point. The subtitle is Adventures in Wildlife Biology. He starts out the chapter called Osprey Penthouse Apartments by talking about his work in the late 70s. And Wilson writes, this was a time when wildlife management was beginning to shift from game management, which focused solely on species humans hunted or harvested, to a broader ecological approach that recognized the importance of biological diversity and keeping all the parts of the ecosystem, as ecologist Aldo Leopold famously argued in his book Round River. He wrote, if the land mechanism as a whole is good, then every part is good, whether we understand it or not. To keep every cog and wheel is the first precaution of intelligent tinkering, unquote. Wilson goes on to talk about the fact that the Bureau of Endangered Resources was established in 1982, and DDT was an issue with bald eagles and osprey. Back to the book. John Olson and I had attended a presentation by Ron Eckstein, the assistant wildlife manager in Rhinelander at the time. Ron, with his technician Fred Johnson, had been constructing artificial nesting platforms for the osprey in Vilas and Oneida counties. Osprey were then a state-listed endangered species, and like eagles, had been negatively affected by DDT and other organochlorine chemicals, as well as the loss of nest sites and death from illegal shooting. The DDT issue was partially solved by banning its use throughout the United States in 1974, but the number of birds was still reduced below what was deemed a recoverable level. At that time, Wisconsin had only 82 breeding pairs of osprey. The department conducted two aerial surveys each year, the first to count nesting pairs of osprey and eagles, and the second to measure productivity by counting chicks. The results showed both species populations were slowly increasing. Ron was having great success boosting osprey populations by installing nesting platforms, as they could be tailored to fit their unique nest requirements. Unlike eagles, who prefer shade and usually nest farther down in the tree's canopy, osprey require a nest site at the top of the tallest tree in an area. They prefer to nest near water because they eat only live fish, whereas eagles eat live fish, dead fish, carrion, small mammals, waterfowl, roadkill deer, you name it. Osprey are also fussy about the neighborhood. They prefer that all the nearby trees are shorter, avoiding locations where eagles or other predators can find a higher perch and look down at their nest and chicks. Lastly, osprey are not very good at expanding their home turf. Wisconsin osprey migrate to South America in the winter, and young birds follow this same path. When these young birds return to the nesting grounds as two-year-old adults, they generally settle within 10 miles of their original birth site. For osprey, finding a location with all these nest characteristics can be quite rare, and even when a perfect site does exist, they face challenges. Building a large nest on top of a live tree is almost impossible because the terminal leader, the top branch reaching skyward, keeps growing upward and is thin and weak. So most natural osprey nests are built in dead trees. Dead trees, of course, have a limited time that they can support a heavy stick nest or withstand wind and the force of gravity because, after all, they are dead. Also, the tops of dead trees are difficult places to securely construct nests as branches often break off and windstorms can blow the nest apart. Ron's platforms look like a solution to the osprey nest site problem. They could be placed in live, super tall red and white pine trees to give them the needed height and stability. We just had to trim off the terminal branches at the top. We could select trees near water bodies with good fish populations and place the platforms within 10 miles of existing osprey territories based on our aerial survey data. We jokingly referred to it as moving the Osprey from slum housing to luxury penthouse apartments. And I'll paraphrase here. They set to putting up as many nest platforms as they could, and picking up a few paragraphs later. After about 3 winters of Osprey platform placement in Iron County, our data started coming in. When combined with Vilas and Oneida County numbers, Osprey in our 3-county area showed remarkable success. We had expanded the turtle flambeau flowage population from 5 to 22 nesting pairs, supporting our theory that nesting habitat was a limiting factor for Iron County Osprey. Osprey platforms also averaged higher chick fledging success than natural nests. We surmised that that was because they were more secure structures and withstood windstorms better than natural nests. This was proven to me firsthand on a couple of occasions. One time in the 80s, John Olson got a call from a resort owner reporting that a spring windstorm had blown over a nest tree just after the birds had returned to the nest. It was a natural nest over water out on the turtle flambeau flowage, and Ken Newman, the resort's owner, asked if there was anything we could do. The nest was visible from his resort's big window in front of the bar, and the birds' activities were quite an attraction for his customers. We located a giant white pine on the opposite shore and put up a platform. After we boated back to the resort landing, Ken offered us hamburgers and Cokes. We had just settled down to begin our meal when Ken pointed out the window. Following his gesture, we looked out and saw 2 osprey land on the platform with sticks in their talons to start building a new nest. John looked at his watch. It had been only 20 minutes since he had rappelled out of the tree. Today, osprey in Wisconsin have been removed from both the state endangered and threatened species lists. The population of bald eagles has also recovered. In 2016, the state reported 1,500 bald eagle nests and 558 osprey nests. Our platforms are still popular housing choices for the state's osprey, with 75% of the nests on artificial platforms. In fact, our high-quality housing even appeals to eagles. When you see an artificial platform today, you should look twice to see which of these impressive raptors is peering down. And now the segment of this chapter called Wrong Tree. And I want to mention here, we're going to learn about a gaboon of Fran and Frederick Hammerstrom, Don Fallon. And I want to remind you that I've read quite a bit of Fran Hammerstrom's work on my show. I've read chapters from her books, and I've also read chapters from books about the Hammerstroms. And if the reading I'm going to do now sparks your interest in the Hammerstroms and what they did, I urge you to look at the archives of the WDRT website, WDRT.org, and look up some of the fun things that I've read about this group of scientists. And back to Wrong Tree and Jeff Wilson. Working on habitat enhancement projects and monitoring wildlife populations was undoubtedly very important work for our crew, but most of us really live for those up-close and personal moments when we actually handled animals. You can take a child to a frog pond and listen to the peepers singing in spring, see the frogs in the shallows, but catch one of those frogs and place it in the child's hand and see what happens. They are drawn to that frog in an intimate way that makes all future encounters more meaningful. It creates the essential connection to nature so eloquently described by biologist Rachel Carson in her book A Sense of Wonder. In the late 1980s, John Olson got a call from a man named Don Fallon who said he wanted to band ospreys in our area. His call gave us a new dimension for our osprey work that involved direct contact with the birds. We had built nest platforms, flown population surveys to count the nesting young, and written nest site management plans. I had even been ground crew for colleagues Ron Eckstein, Chuck Sindelar, and Dave Evans, looking on with envy as they climbed massive nest trees to band eagle chicks in their eyries. Now, we were going to have the opportunity to have a real wild bird in the hand. While outwardly maintaining a cool professional demeanor, I was secretly ecstatic at the prospect of this new opportunity. Don was the guru of Osprey Banding in Wisconsin. He had a direct connection up the wildlife management family tree to Aldo Leopold. Don had banded birds with Fran and Frederick Hammy Hammerstrom, who were Leopold's graduate students and famous for their work with Wisconsin prairie chickens, hawks, and eagles. Like Leopold, the Hammerstroms had developed quite a reputation in the field and mentored many up-and-coming biologists at their research farm in central Wisconsin. Fran dubbed those who worked on hawks and climbed trees gaboons, and Don was one of Fran's gaboons. Don wanted to learn more about osprey. At the time, they were listed as endangered in our state, and many aspects of their life cycle were still shrouded in mystery. Don wanted to document chick survival and migration data. He was interested in how many chicks fledged from our nests, how many survive migration, and what routes the birds followed on their southern trips to Peru, Colombia, and Brazil. He felt we needed more data on return rates of chicks to natal areas and causes of mortality between their initial flight to South America and their first return to the nesting grounds 2 years later. Even questions such as dispersal rates, did they nest in the vicinity of their natal nest or show up elsewhere in the state, were foggy at best. A long-term banding project could fill some of our information gaps and help with population recovery. This would require climbing into nests and placing aluminum Fish and Wildlife Service bands on the legs of nestlings. We knew where most of our active nests were located, both natural and man-made, but not all would be good candidates for banding. Our first step was to identify which nests were safe to climb and had chicks that year. Don was a USFWS certified master bander and would provide the numbered bands and train us on how to take measurements and safely handle the birds. The day before banding, John and I carefully went through our gear to make sure everything was shipshape. John was concerned that we conduct ourselves professionally, thinking that if we really impressed Don, he might decide to continue banding with us in the future. John pointed out that I must listen to Don first, then ask questions, and that being near the nest put stress on the birds, so we needed to be efficient. John was really laying on the pressure. Observing that Don was a certified private bander while we represented the State Department of Natural Resources, and as state employees, this was our chance to impress him with our professionalism. We even decided to wear our uniform shirts, the khaki-colored ones, with the DNR patch on the sleeve that we wore when giving talks to the public. I had no doubt Don was going to be impressed. Secretly, John and I were as excited as kids on Christmas morning. The day finally arrived, and John and I got to the station early. We were dressed neatly and had everything in order. We had decided to start on an easy climber, so we picked the nest platform on North Bass Lake for our first tree. It was a few miles east of Mercer, and the boat landing access was directly across the lake from the nest. It would be a short boat ride, and the tree was within 20 yards of the shore. As we talked the plan through, we decided that because it was our first nest and because this tree had plenty of limbs at the top to sit on, we'd climb it together. That way there would be two of us if we had difficulties handling the nestlings. When Don pulled up in an old Dodge pickup with a grumbling muffler, he was wearing faded blue jeans and a brown stained T-shirt with a bottle of Cutter's insect repellent sticking out of the pocket. He wore a dilapidated ball cap with unkempt curly brown hair sticking out over his sideburns. His skin was tanned and leathery from days spent in the field, and his grin reached from ear to ear. John and I in our neat uniforms were quite the contrast. John suggested I ride with Don, and John would drive our truck and tow the boat. We'd do our planning and training session at the landing. Off we went. Don talked nonstop, drove with his left hand, and was constantly reaching up on the dash for his binoculars if he saw the slightest movement out of the window that he thought might be a raptor. He even drove while looking through his binoculars, and I yelled out once when he veered for the shoulder. The dash of his truck was covered with feathers, skulls, bones, and fishing tackle, no doubt things he'd retrieved from osprey nests. He was definitely the real thing, one of Franz Gaboon's. I knew immediately I was going to like this guy. When we got to North Bass Lake, we launched the boat, and Don gave us a training session. He told us how to safely handle the chicks, what to do if one jumped from the nest, and gave us a wire hook to reach a chick if it was on the opposite side of the nest and acted like it was about to jump. He explained how to pre-bend the bands so the lock-on part would connect smoothly, how to find and measure the eighth primary feather to determine age, and finished by explaining how to hold and safely replace the chicks in the nest. As John had suggested, I took all this in and didn't ask many questions. We were looking organized and professional, and John seemed happy. We pointed out the nest tree to Don, a tall white pine barely protruding above a clump of similar pines surrounding it. The nest was about 60 feet up, and we could see an adult osprey perched on the edge of the platform, brooding the chicks by shading them with its wings. We crossed the lake without saying a word. I drove the boat, Don sat in the middle, and John took the bow. When we landed, John carefully got out and tied up the boat. Don got out next, and we passed the gear forward until it was neatly arranged on the bank. John and I slipped into our harnesses and climbing spikes, and because John would climb first above me, we tied our rappelling rope to John's belt. Lastly, Don zipped 3 leg bands and the banding pliers into John's pocket. John started up the tree, all of us remaining quiet. I waited until he was 5 feet above me and then started my climb, 10 feet, 20 feet, 30, until we were halfway. I was full of adrenaline, and I knew John felt the same way. When we got to the first limbs, the canopy closed in, and I could only see straight up. At about 40 feet, I lost sight of John, so I just followed the rope. Then the rope stopped moving, and my head bumped something. It was John's rear end, but I knew we still had at least 10 more feet before we hit the top. Something wasn't right. John turned and looked down at me. His eyebrows were raised, and he looked stunned. Then a sheepish grin appeared and spread from ear to ear. I was baffled. I climbed closer and whispered, "What's the matter?" John leaned down, looked me in the face, and whispered back, "Wrong tree." I looked over my shoulder at a neighboring pine about 20 feet away and saw 2 osprey chicks staring at us. I was shocked. So much for impressing the renowned Don Fallon with our professionalism. Instead, we looked like a couple of idiots. When we got to the ground, John walked over to the correct tree and started up. As I walked past Don, he whispered, "What happened?" "Wrong tree," I said with embarrassment. "Oh," he whispered, "that's happened to me too." We climbed the correct tree and banded our first osprey chicks without any further problems. After we loaded the boat and started motoring away, we really lost it, laughing out of control. We couldn't stop laughing about it all day. John and I banded with Don for the next few years and became great friends. Don could tell a story, and I'm sure this one was retold by him many times. That day we learned more than to double-check the tree. We never wore our uniform shirts again for osprey work. It was quite a job washing out the pine sap. Don passed away in 1988. When John Olson later transferred to La Crosse, I became a sub-permittee bander under another master bander named Chris Cold. In 1993, Bruce Bacon became the wildlife manager at Mercer. Bruce was a master bander, and between the three of us, we've banded over 500 osprey nestlings in the area. We've received band returns from as far away as Peru. Years later, we added numeral-etched color bands and were able to document our own nestling returns to the area by using a spotting scope to read the numbers on live birds. And I'll stop reading there. I love seeing the Hammerstroms enter into other people's lives in these other books. I've been reading excerpts from Wrong Tree, Adventures in Wildlife Biology by Jeff Wilson, and illustrations by Terry Dalton. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thank you so much for listening.